Welcome on in to Studio 2 on a Thursday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
On a Thursday, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Busy show today, Cherry. Very book-heavy show today. Mm-hmm. We're going to end the show. The final segment is about books coming out in the early part of 2024. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk with Dina Halick, who works at the Free Library of Philadelphia, is going to tell us about some titles to look for if you're a fiction person.
I'm not, but you know what? I feel like...
Well, part of our job is to...
I feel like she's going to get us in the know.
Keep an open mind. Mm-hmm. We read a lot of nonfiction for this show, which does crowd out the time for fiction. Only so many hours in the day, but maybe Dina can sell us some of these books coming out. And then the middle segment today, we're going to discuss a book with its authors who are Philly-based. This is a book about how to survive various types of calamities.
And so I'm excited about this.
You are.
And because we joke a lot, and I always talk about that I feel like I would at least try to survive the first round of a zombie apocalypse, right?
You've thought about this.
I've thought about this quite often, and I want to know. What do I need to know to make it out alive?
Yeah. Maybe this is not the time for this conversation, but I am curious why you think about that a lot.
You are kind of like mildly obsessed with this topic. I've talked about it a lot. We'll talk about why, but there's a lot of reasons.
That's off mic.
But I'm excited about the book is called Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook Apocalypse.
The authors are Josh Piven and Dave Borgenicht. They'll be with us next segment.
Absolutely.
Later this segment, we're going to talk with Tom McDonald. You know Tom. WHYY's Tom McDonald is at City Hall covering the first council session of the year. But before we get into any of that, Cherry, let's talk about some headlines. Go ahead.
Yeah, this has been a big story since yesterday. Police, they're still searching for Shane Pryor, the 17-year-old who escaped from juvenile detention center staff while at CHOP yesterday. He had been taken to the Children's Hospital because he had a hand injury, and then he escaped in the parking lot. He had not been shackled or handcuffed. He was seen going in and out of nearby buildings, asking for a phone. Now, Pryor's backstory is that he was 14 years old when he was arrested in 2020 for allegedly killing a woman and has been housed at the juvenile detention center. During interviews, Pryor told police he solicited the victim for sexual acts, but the woman had been shot by another man. He said he was innocent, and now he sort of escaped. His mother, his attorney, asking for him to turn himself in. Take a listen to his mom.
He just was at the wrong place at the wrong time. There's someone else involved, and he's just scared. He's a scared little boy. He's been in there since he was 14. He's 17 and about to turn 18, and he's scared. He doesn't realize what he's doing.
Yeah, he's maintained his innocence so far. His attorney says his client lost hope when a request to move his case to juvenile court was denied, and now he's making it worse. Yeah.
Yeah, and we should clarify, too, that his mother is asking him
to come back, to turn himself in.
There's also speculation, or not just speculation, official word that perhaps an accomplice was involved in all of this. We don't know everything yet, as with any evolving situation, but we'll keep our eye on it.
Yeah, more information will be coming as the day continues.
Here's something that's also been evolving, Cherry, ever since we started this show and well before it. Wind energy in New Jersey. You might recall that the Danish company Ørsted was set to build a couple of wind farms off the shores of New Jersey. We talked about it extensively on the show. Then Ørsted said, no thanks. We're pulling out. Too expensive.
Feasible.
It's not feasible.
Mm-hmm.
New Jersey didn't love that answer, especially New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, who's made wind energy and renewable energy a huge part of his legacy and agenda in the Garden State. And so they put out proposals for more wind farms, and now they have unanimously approved two new proposals. This was approved yesterday by New Jersey's Board of Public Utilities. One project 47 miles off the coast of Atlantic City, another 42 miles off the coast of Seaside Heights. And this is all toward the goal of trying to move New Jersey toward 100% clean energy by 2035. So two new big proposals.
Yeah.
And we will see if they meet the finish line.
Yeah. To me, this shows how gritty the Garden State is and how committed they are to this goal by Governor Murphy. One of the factoids that I was drawn to is that, you know, these two projects are expected to power up to 1.8 million homes, create 27,000 new jobs, and inject $3 billion into the state's economy. So it's a pretty big deal for them. But that Ørsted, I mean, we had it's been a very contentious thing, these wind turbines. I mean, we did a whole show on it. People called in. They felt some kind of way. So we'll see what happens with these two projects, whether they'll actually come to fruition. Yep. We don't know.
I mean, the cliche is once bitten, twice shy, but not in this case. Once bitten, and they're going in for another bite. So let's see if these two projects. I also thought it was notable. Mm-hmm. There is one project that was approved long ago that is going forward. And that same company went in for these two new proposals, and New Jersey did not pick them. And I think the implication, at least in the reporting by our own Susan Phillips, is that they kind of want to spread out the risk here, not be so dependent on one company coming through. And so now there are three different companies involved in three different projects. And if there are more projects, you might imagine it's going to be, you know, until someone proves that they can get it all the way through, they're not going to trust any one company
and
anymore.
And this is more expensive than the Ørsted project.
Yeah, for ratepayers potentially.
Yeah, so we shall see. Avi, question for you.
Yeah.
How would you feel about jumping into one of Philadelphia's public pools in February?
How would I feel? But why am I doing it?
Yeah. Are you wild enough to do it? Yes or no?
Yes. I'm so wild. Gosh.
You kind of
one of those wild public radio personalities. Go ahead.
Well, the Parks and Rec announced that it is hosting its second Philly Freeze event, and it's looking for 500 people crazy enough to plunge into the frigid Kelly Pool on February 24th. So you might
What is this? Raise money? Raise awareness?
Yeah, this is raising money and for recruiting lifeguards. You know, through donations from the people who plunge and corporate sponsors, the city hopes to raise enough money to help entice these new lifeguards for the summer and keep the pools open. And as you know, there has been a national lifeguard shortage, and it's made things really hard in Philly for the past few years because a lot of people don't know how to swim, and they can't necessarily pass the lifeguard test. But you know, they offer opportunities for them, and they're hoping they can give them signing bonuses. And if you, Avi, jump into a pool February 24th, you help the young people, man.
That can make some good audio, too.
Maybe,
I'll tie this back into what we just talked about, the chilly waters off of the New Jersey coast. Uh-huh. One year on New Year's Day, I did run into the ocean
You did the polar bear?
I did off of the, where was I? I guess Ventnor area. And it was pretty thrilling, you know. At the time, it stinks. But then you look back 5 years later and you go, oh, that's a nice memory. So this would be the same thing.
You like spicy food and cold water. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll go ahead to the next topic. Mm-hmm. All right, Cherry. Mm-hmm. We already let machines do a lot of our matchmaking for us via apps. Mm-hmm. But maybe, just maybe, we can export even more of the dating process to technology. Wired has a piece out today about a new app called, I think I'm saying this right, Volar, just came out in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It works like other dating platforms. You know, you put in your profile information, you get matched with other people. But here is the twist. Your profile gets then sort of spun off into an AI chatbot, which then goes on virtual first dates with other people's AI chatbots. And they have like little 10-message exchanges with each other, the bots do. And then you get to review the messages to see if this is someone you want to maybe take it a little further with. Okay, Cherry. Volar, you in?
I am not in.
You're
and
out.
Let me tell you why. Because as someone who had been on the dating scene and has used the apps, I mean, if you really can't even go on a first date, if you want to, maybe you're not ready to date. Maybe you really are not ready to date a human.
So I don't think it's a replacement for the whole first date. It's designed to, I'm taking this from the article, to help people skip the earliest, often cringy stages of chatting with a new match. So just export that part of it.
But yeah, but that's part of it.
You think that's the struggle part of it?
I mean, you know, go to the meet people at the pub, at the bar, like, or just in sports, whatever. It's like we have to go back to just meeting people not injecting AI. I'm against it, but hey, whatever. I don't want to stop people from trying to date. So,
robot overlords, get out of our dating lives. Okay.
Too much. Now on to our newsmaker, Avi. Philadelphia's new city council. They are meeting for the very first time as we speak, and there's a whole lot of new in City Hall these days. Council members will be working with a new mayor and a new council president in Kenyatta Johnson. Plus, Many of the council members themselves are relatively new to the job.
WHYY reporter Tom McDonald joins us from City Hall to discuss the issues and priorities on top of the agenda this session. Tom, it's great to have you back on Studio 2.
Good afternoon.
So, Tom, we alluded to the agenda. What is at the top of the agenda as this session gets going?
Well, when we start a new council session, you have the priorities such as homelessness, such as poverty, a couple of the other priorities that are coming in, the new potential Sixers arena. I know you've discussed that on numerous occasions at Studio 2. And there's also talk about whether that will go forward this session. And of course, we've got a new mayor and a new budget, and a budget's got to be done in the next several months just to make sure that everything eases right into the new fiscal year.
And what does the process potentially look like for council approving or not approving the Sixers arena proposal in this session? Like, what are the steps that might happen over the next few weeks and months?
Well, if you trust the process working, you've got the council receiving an independent report about the efficacy of having a downtown arena. I had a chance to speak with Councilman Mark Squilla this morning. Nothing is going to move forward until that's done, and that could still be another month or two, and we're looking to see what will happen once that comes across his desk and everybody's desk. You know that's going to get leaked out at some point. We've also got a moving through of zoning bills, but that all will be possibly stopped when the lawsuits start flying. The anti-Chinatown group that are against this, you know, the group from Chinatown that are against this, already had a protest out front of City Hall this morning welcoming the council members as they came in the building saying they do not want that downtown arena.
Wow, what a welcome on the first day of the first council session.
I mean, there were about 100 people there. They had tents up because of the rain, and they wanted to make sure that they were going to be a visual reminder every step of the way.
Well, you know, Tom, I mean, new council president, Kenyatta Johnson there. So many new members. I think 12 of 17 are either freshmen or fairly new to council. What will be the challenges? And I ask this with a part B to the question, because, I mean, have folks really staffed up to get work done?
Staffing is not a problem in city council. People, you know, city council's got a group of, roving staffers, you know, that are always available and around. And there are people who have moved from offices of the previous group of council members, most of whom ran for mayor. And there's plenty of people staffing up the council. And you see a lot of people held over from the last administration. The interesting part about this is going to be whether you can find a group of votes in order to move this forward. Now, the one thing that we have to explore here is council prerogative, which is the district council member always has the ability to control legislation within their district. That's Mark Squilla. Like I said, spoke to Squilla this morning. But he also reminded me that at least once in memory, they have pushed something through with an independent at-large council member. And that's also a possibility. I mean, the people who want this arena want it really badly.
Quick follow-up. There are a lot of Democrats on council. Now we have two Working Family Party members, just one Republican holding on. Will this be a council that will find agreement on most issues? Or, like in this case of the Sixers arena, could there be some serious divisions?
You know, it's an interesting question. Many have called getting enough votes to pass crucial legislation like herding cats in city council, and that's without the group of firebrands that are a lot younger than the old council members, not as much party affiliated. And, you know, on that Republican line, Brian O'Neill wanted to be marked as present this morning because there's a minority, but the minority is the Working Families Party, so he's the third party in city council.
Wow. It's amazing to think about. That was a WHYY reporter, Tom McDonald, getting us up to date on what to expect with city council this session. A lot of eyeballs going to be on that big building right in the middle of Philadelphia. Tom McDonald, thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So coming up next, Sherry, we're talking about this little book I got in my hand. It's called The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook Apocalypse, written by a couple of Philly guys, Josh Piven and David Borgenicht. And basically, it contains anything you would need to know about how to survive all sorts of calamities.
Yeah.
And after reading it, I don't know if I'm assuaged, but I am interested to talk to these folks. If you're interested in talking to them, mm-hmm. give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. Stick with us.
Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And our next segment got me thinking, do I have the skills and know-how to survive a doomsday scenario, climate disaster, even deadlier pandemic, zombies, aliens? I think the answer is probably no, but these are some of the serious and silly scenarios we confront in the latest book from a pair of Philadelphia-based authors, Josh Piven and David Borgenicht. The book is called The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook, Apocalypse. And I should say, it's sort of written tongue-in-cheek at times, but the advice contained in this book is actual vetted advice from experts.
Yeah, Josh and David came out with their first survival handbook back in 1999, right before Y2K. Remember that? This new Apocalypse edition provides practical advice like how to pack a go bag. It also has information you hope you'll never need, like how to determine if the alien invaders are friendly or not. Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a tough one. You want to feel that out, for
sure. You got to feel that out. We asked Josh and Dave to come in and answer all of our survival questions and talk about the tongue-in-cheek book. Welcome to Studio 2, Josh and Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And of course, friends, if you have survival questions, even far out ones, call us or email us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
All right. So much to cover here. But I was interested in the fact that the book very, very early on talks not about sort of like practical advice with what to do with your tarp or whatever, or how to hunt a bear. It talks about mentality in the very, very beginning. And you say perception of control is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I'll ask you first, Josh, what does that mean?
Well, I think in situations that are really difficult and out of control, there are a few things you can't control, and one of them is your attitude and your reaction to things. So, you know, we always say, you know, keep calm, be prepared, have a plan. So, of course, you can think more clearly if you've actually considered some of these things and you have a positive mental attitude. You're probably less likely to panic, you know, if you see the asteroids streaking across the sky. And certainly, you know, if you've read the book and done a little research, you'll know what to do in these difficult situations. But certainly centering yourself and having a positive attitude and knowing that typically things, you know, usually work out better than you expect. You know, this is always a good way to start.
Let's keep calm and carry on. Although I have to say, you mentioned earlier in the book about how, you know, human beings are very adaptable. We can survive a lot. But then I'm thinking, how would I keep that type of optimism amid the collapse of structures that human beings have created? Because in some of these scenarios, these are like sort of more self-inflicted wounds as opposed to an asteroid. So help me do that, Dave. Like, how would I actually keep faith in humanity's adaptability even as I'm watching human society, you know, collapse
fall
in on
apart.
Itself? Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me my pep talk, I guess.
The pep talk, I mean, it's really about remembering that the antithesis of that is going to make you even less likely to survive. It's really just remembering that you're not helping anybody by freaking out. You're certainly not going to help yourself. You'll expend your resources. You'll make mistakes. You'll act out of fear rather than intention. And so it's really truly about taking some breaths. Staying in control and not panicking, because that's really when we all make mistakes. We know there's no such thing as rushing or multitasking. That's when we screw things up. And so if the world's falling apart, the only way you're going to be able to put it back together is if you put yourself back together first.
I got to ask, because I've become obsessed kind of with gaining the skills to survive a zombie apocalypse. But seriously, do survive, you know, a weather emergency, an evacuation, all these things. I got to ask you, Josh, what made you say, you know what, it's time for a new edition and it's going to be titled Apocalypse here?
It's going to have zombies.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I guess the short answer is COVID. But even before COVID, we knew that we wanted to do something related to climate change related global catastrophes, because mm-hmm. that's obviously on everybody's mind. Then COVID happened. It felt like, you know, this is really different this time. Like this is serious. We didn't know, you know, what the morbidity was. We didn't you know, it was all new to us. This was, you know, this first kind of really serious virus. So I think during COVID we sat down and we're like, you know, This feels a little bad, a little apocalyptic. You know, maybe there's something here. So we worked in, you know, super viruses and things like that, and of course some of the climate change situations. But we wanted to also give it the kind of tongue in cheek worst case treatment. So we also included zombies. And I think if you think of like a brain eating virus, or you go back to The Last of Us, you know, these things, while they seem like they're far fetched, who knows, right? I mean, who would have said we would have had COVID? I mean, it was just something that a lot of us couldn't have imagined. So I think that was kind of the impetus, and we kind of sat down and did our usual, well, what are people afraid of? And that was kind of the general genesis for the book.
And Dave, I you know, there's so many movies and series. There are zombies. We have asteroids coming to Earth. You know, we have blackouts. One of the movies I just saw, Leave the World Behind, kind of crazy. Why do you think we're so obsessed with playing out these worst case end of the world scenarios in film?
I mean, I think in times of heightened existential anxiety, these movies obviously become more prevalent, and same in the world of books. But I think it's almost a response to, you know, it's a way to deal with these. If you imagine the worst and then you see it playing out, or read about it playing out, or do the research about how it might play out, you actually do stand a better chance of just, again, staying calm when things do go awry. You've envisioned it. You're not just obsessed and freaking out by it.
Like, in a weird way, I've seen this before, yeah.
Was this a comforting project to do this for you personally?
Yeah, I think all the books have. I mean, I think at the end of the day, the reason the brand has been around for 20 years is that it kind of low-key helps people think and know that there are going to be ways to survive their worst fears. It's sort of a very positive message, even though we're talking about very dark things.
Okay, I did want to ask about some of the specifics.
Sure.
Just weird stuff that stuck out to me. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in there about bunkers and how to build a bunker, where not to build a bunker. And then there's just like dropped in there out of nowhere, this anecdote that there's like already an underground bunker community in Kansas, or they're planning one. Josh, what is going on? There are already bunkers out there?
Trust me, if there's a way to make a buck, somebody's going to figure out how to do it. And there is a subculture of bunkers. You know, you can, you know, starting at the low end, right? So it's kind of, you know, the typical kind of just like
a three-star bunker,
right? The Four Seasons of bunkers, right? So there's the low end where you maybe be able to get one of these things for like $4,000 and just bury it. And then there are ones that are disused missile silos that have been purchased by entrepreneurs and converted, and they have full-time security outside. And, you know, now we're talking into like the seven-figure price tags,
right?
You know, so I guess this is maybe where the technocrats or the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world go, and they buy these bunkers, and yeah, they're, you know, a lot of them are in disused military bases, and they're fully kitted out. I mean, they have ventilation, they have food for years. I mean, multiple years of survival.
Well, can I ask you though a follow up on that? The psychology of folks who are already kind of prepping,
preppers, yeah,
survivalist preppers, whatever you want to call them. Like, what do you think? And I'll give this to Dave. What do you think draws people to that? Is it because I could imagine it might just be like a hobby, and it's fun to talk about your hobby and do your hobby with other people that share your interests. Is it kind of just that, or do you think there is psychologically something more to the folks who are really actively doing this work already?
I mean, I think you probably have a whole range of experiences there, right? Like people, some people are just into the knowledge and into it. It makes them feel better to know how to mm-hmm. how to build, you know, shelter, how to stock a bunker, how to trap animals, whatever it is, how to detect weather conditions are safe. Like this kind of knowledge is comforting. But then there are certainly people who are, a little more on the conspiratorial side of things mm-hmm. and really just don't trust the institutions that, the government, the electrical grid, the supply chain, and maybe they're right. Because it's pretty
precarious.
I mean,
someday inevitably they will be right, right?
It's very
so if you take a long enough view of this.
I mean, we are precariously close to midnight when it comes to a lot of this stuff.
Yep, 90 seconds now, they said.
Yeah, so
90 seconds.
The doomsday clock?
Yeah, interesting.
So hopefully, one of the things we can do is use the message of our fear and anxiety to actually try to move the clock a little back.
Yep.
I would add the prepper mantra is kind of like Fight Club. Like if you're a prepper, don't tell everybody you're a prepper because then they'll know you're a prepper and then you have a bunker in your backyard. So, keep it to yourself.
If you are just tuning in, we are speaking with Josh Piven, playwright, speechwriter, and Dave Borgen-Nicht, founder of Quirk Books. They are the co-authors of Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook Series. Their most recent is the Apocalypse Edition. If you have questions about surviving worst case scenarios, you can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. And the email is studio2@whyy.org. I'll say that number again. 888-477-9499. So
we've got a caller yelling at us, Cherry.
Yeah, I see. we're about to get to that. And I guess I was going to set up, I guess we'll they want to get to more practical advice. One of the first things you start with in the book when you get serious is a go bag. And my other half is a Marine and retired Marine and is very obsessed with this go bag. Tell us, what should you have? And you actually say that they should be packed. And then there's also, if you only have 30 minutes, Josh, I'll start with you. What should we gather?
Sure. So there are some essentials, things that you absolutely should have in there. And that would include things like your passports and things that you'll need, like a list of all your passwords. So if you have to access your account, obviously a portable battery is helpful for cell phones. You should also, if you can, keep copies of some of the stuff in the cloud if you can't access it. So there's those types of things, medications. There's more practical things that you may need. So let's say like heavy duty trash bags to keep you dry if you're in an emergency evacuation situation, and obviously things like duct tape can really be helpful. Enough water, if you can last a long time without food, but you should have some water, especially if you're in a dry climate. It's helpful if you have most of the stuff already done, but we do give you kind of a TikTok on, this is what you need to do in the first 5 minutes and to get the bag in there. And, don't make it like, your four-wheeled rolly bag. I mean, it needs to be a pretty solid duffel bag that is weatherproof for some of this stuff.
And my follow-up question to you, Dave, is we have let a lot of our skills atrophy because of our reliance on technology. And so are there like skills that you think we need to strengthen? And this wasn't necessarily discussed in the book, and Josh, feel free to chime in. Are there skills we need to strengthen that we've become weak in because we are relying on this phone and GPS and all those things that we would need in case of a worst case scenario?
I mean, yeah, that's a great example. Just learning how to read a map and tell what direction you're pointed in would be a one thing. There's one of our earlier books actually talks about how to build a compass on your own using the magnetic poles or just other indicators of where you are. Building a fire, there are multiple ways to go about that, but it would be good to familiarize yourself with that. Building a shelter, animal trapping.
Purifying water.
Purifying water or detecting.
Purifying urine too, right? That's in the book
as
well.
Yeah, if you need to drink your own urine. Now we're really down in the worst case scenario.
Plug your ears,
weeds,
folks,
right?
Guess,
right. Yeah. So yeah, we have that as well. It's you don't want to have it right out of your body. There's right. a couple steps involved.
But also just basic first aid, you know, refamiliarize yourself with how to bandage a wound and tie a tourniquet, perform a tracheotomy, like emergency CPR. These kind of things would be good to refamiliarize yourself with.
We're talking with the authors Josh Piven and David Borgenicht about their new book, The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook, Apocalypse. You can chime in, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Comment here from Ken in Philly, who says, we need to become more self-reliant. Mm-hmm. We should all know how to grow our own food. That's in the book, by the way. And you talk about some of the plants that are best to grow if you really need like quick calorie
survival
intake.
Garden.
Give us a sense of what a survival garden
looks
like.
Some of it is based on climate, right? If you live in Philadelphia or you live in Vermont, you don't necessarily have a 12-month growing season like you might have in Florida. So, you know, we delve into that. Stockpiling seeds is also important if you think you're going to need those in the future. You got to start somewhere in order to grow your plants. But, things that are high in protein, soybeans and things like that. I think corn is another big one because it can be used for multiple things. But there are different varieties of corn that will grow in different parts of the country. So, we cover all of this and, of course, also how to do a composter and things like that. So, it takes some land, obviously. So it is important to have land. And we talk about that, too, as, you know, one of those things. You know, if you think the apocalypse is coming, hopefully you have some land that where you can kind of escape to. It's a good land will be valuable after the apocalypse.
And I want to tee up a clip because I recently watched this film starring Julia Roberts and our hometown hero, Kevin Bacon. It's called Leave the World Behind. And in this clip, it resonates with me because Ethan Hawke, he's in there. He's a dad named Clay. His family is on vacation when the country is hit with this unprecedented blackout and appears to be some sort of radiation or nuclear attack. And he's trying to get help from this guy. And take a listen.
The only way this ends is if you get back in your vehicle and drive away now.
Drive away to what? All the roads are blocked. We're in the middle of God knows where. There's no one else around.
I have no idea what I am supposed to do right now. I can barely do anything without my cell phone and my GPS. I am a useless man. But you are a very prepared man.
And so that's like that line has I've been obsessed with that line because I'm like a useless man and then this prepared guy. And one of the things you talk about is how money is not worth very much that you
it's
need
like
to
kindling.
Have. It's like nothing. Yeah. You can use it to start the fire.
That's right.
When the world breaks down. And so can you talk about like some of the things you should stock up on and how they actually become very valuable in worst case scenario situations, and you lay this out in the book.
Yeah, we do have a list of barterable items. It's going to be a little debatable what's going to be in demand. You know, obviously, supplies. You know, canned goods. Probably alcohol is going to be useful both for
people like that.
Solar whiskey. Chargers, mm-hmm. things, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, batteries,
Batteries, of course, radios, flashlights. I do think. I did watch that movie, and that was like Ethan Hawke totally overacting in that scene. But it speak to me.
I just wanted Kevin Bacon to do the angry dance from Footloose. I thought that was going to happen.
Yes, Footloose was some of our worst case scenarios when we were in high school.
Ethan Hawke did do a good job of convincing him to help at the end of the day. They both
right.
did.
Well, and guns, I mean, weapons, they do play a big part in particular in that scene. Yeah. And I do think, you know, once you're at a point where your paper money is worthless, right? Your gold is worthless because it's simply ornamental. It doesn't really have any use. Then you get to a point where I need a barterable item. I need something
some
that I can trade, right? I need some chickens. I need some batteries. I need this or that. You know, these are the things that are going to become important if there's a true permanent collapse of civilization.
So we're talking about money, and that's going to allow me to set up my clip for this segment.
Yeah, set it up. Yeah.
So this is a scene from the NBC sitcom 30 Rock. And this is a scene where it appears the financial system is melting down. So the executives of the General Electric Corporation gather in a room and they pop in this pre-recorded message from the CEO played by Rip Torn.
I'm speaking to you in the year 1987, but my message is timeless. Avoid the Noid. We've all worked hard, but now it's over. There's only one thing for you to do. Go to your loved ones. Hold them close. Because in the end, and if you're watching this, it is the end. Love is all that matters.
I'm going to be honest, Dave. That's me. I'm giving up. I honestly think you have to confront your mortality sometimes in really dire situations. And that might, maybe I wouldn't actually do this if there was, you know, a total societal collapse. But from my vantage point right now, that's kind of, I feel like, how I would try to process it. Be like, look, it's over. Like, Dave, is that wrong?
No. I mean, that's another way to go. I mean, the Beatles had it right, right? Love is all you need.
Yeah.
I mean, we hope. I'm with you too. I mean, as much as I enjoy having written all these books with Josh and knowing what I know, I still believe in the goodness of humanity and the power of my own ability to just identify the good people and convince them that we should help each other, that we're stronger together. But at the same time, I do sometimes think about, I did think about buying a gun during COVID.
Wow.
I did not do it. So, you know, come find me, guys. Just take everything I got. And
he'll be in his bunker. Don't worry.
the bunker.
Yeah, he's got $1 million bunker in Kansas.
Yeah, I just don't really want to.
They won't find you. They won't find you, Dave.
But I don't really want to. I'm not sure I want to live in a world where it is that dire and dark and people aren't helping each other. So I'm just going to, you know, let it happen if it does.
And I want to read this email, this question from Sean, who says, in the event the U.S. was taken over by a dictator, how would a resistance movement be formed and allow like-minded individuals to contact it? I mean, you kind of talk
counteract
about
counteract it is what he's probably
saying.
Yeah,
counteract.
It said contact, but I would think.
But it's sort of, you guys talk about how to identify good people. If you're on the rebuild side, you kind of talk about the psychology of good people and how to tell who's good and who's bad. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we do touch on, not just if the world kind of devolves into different clans, but also how to rebuild utopia, or perhaps build, not rebuild, since I don't think we're there yet. but just, you know, having a society where each according to his ability and each according to his need, right? It sounds like communism, but I will say everybody has a role, and, you know, you have to figure out what each person can contribute, and then you have to be able to at least have some sort of way to agree, whether that's consensus or you have a some sort of person that's in charge and people have put their faith in. But you do have to at least have a society where everybody feels like they're contributing, based on whatever their skill is. So that is definitely one of the things that we talk about. We don't necessarily get into dealing with dictators, I would say. I guess I would start with civil disobedience being the first thing, but hopefully we're not headed in that direction.
Well, so that actually brings me up to maybe my main point of confusion when reading the book, which is I feel like there is some conflicting advice about how to deal with the other people who have survived. And this really gets into some deep philosophical questions. Like, there's some advice that's like, don't camp too close to the river or the trail because other people will find you. And there's other advice like, but you have to find other people and try to band together to survive. In different sections of the book, you know what I mean? And I'm just like, it left me wondering, like,
it's like The Last of Us, right?
Yeah,
it's like you're going to have different clans that have different intentions toward you,
yeah.
I think.
Like, how do you deal with other people in a scenario like this? And what does that say about your own sort of intuition about humanity? Dave, you want to
take that one for the world?
Yeah.
I think, you know, you have to trust your instincts and look for the indicators that they're, you know, watch their actions, not their words, right?
Yeah.
You want to be suspicious at first, I would say. But if they're asking for help or if they're demonstrating value and offering you something of value, some sort of exchange of skills or exchange of support, they're probably trustworthy. If they are seeming a little bit suspiciously victim-like or desperate but are not really offering anything else of value, and then you see them taking notes. If you see them drawing maps,
journalists are very suspect in this scenario.
You know,
they'll be the first to go. Don't worry, Avi.
If they disappear for hours on end to go report back to their other group, you know, these are things.
And I got to throw out there, because one of the things that stood out to me is look out for the birds. You know, the birds tell you a lot.
The birds are falling out of the sky. Canaries and coal mines. It is not a good thing.
That's the authors of the Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook Apocalypse, Josh Piven, David Borgenick. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks. Be safe out there.
Yes. Coming up, looking for a good book? Well, we've got some great suggestions of some new releases in every genre. Stick with us. Lots to come. End of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Errant Cherry.
Yes.
We read a lot of books for Studio 2.
A lot of books.
A lot
yes.
of books. And I'm appreciative of that, actually. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the show's helped turn me into a bit of a bookworm, whereas before I was more of like an article reader. And I'm enjoying that quite
a
bit.
Me too, Avi. I mean, I always liked to read growing up, but never such a broad variety of genres as we get to read here on Studio 2. But there is one person who is an even bigger bookworm than we are, Avi.
Tell me.
Yes. The bookworm in chief.
The bookworm in chief.
Yes, I know. Dana Halick. I know you didn't know that was your job, but that
it is. It is now. I'm going to take it. I might put that on my business card.
And on the business card, she is the department head of Philbrick Hall, the fiction and DVD department of the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia. And Dina is with us today to get us all excited for some of the newest releases of some local and national authors. Dina, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Thank you. There's actually so many good books coming out. I am reading into July already for this coming year.
Oh, you get advanced copies?
I do. I do.
That is wonderful.
The perks are pretty great.
And do your friends try to hit you up for...
but I'm not allowed.
Oh, really?
Ooh. Yeah, no, they give me the ARC and I'm not like, here, this. No, they want you to buy the book.
Absolutely. So. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I appreciate your ethical approach to this. I would also appreciate if you could, you know, give us a few titles to really get us interested. And I know, for instance, that you are looking forward to Come and Get It by Kylie Reed. And this one caught my eye. Can you tell us more?
Sure. Kylie Reed, actually, her first book, which was Such a Fun Age, it was longlisted for the Booker Award. It was set in Philadelphia. She was living here when she wrote it. She is now off on her next career. But she wrote this book. Come and Get It comes out on the 30th, and it takes place in 2017 at the University of Arkansas, and it follows a resident, an RA. And she's constantly hustling. Her dream is to graduate, buy a small house, and so the ideas of money are always in her head, and she ends up meeting this visiting professor called Agatha, and she starts getting in with her and agreeing to help her out with some ethically gray stuff. And so her kind of side hustle to get all this money to buy her house gets jeopardized by some odd new friends, an illicit intrigue. It's a book about money, indiscretion, bad behavior on campus, class, economics, race.
This feels like a Netflix series already.
It does. It really does. Yeah, so that's coming out next week.
Next week. Okay, and that's Come and Get It by Kylie Reed. All right, I'm excited about that.
And there's a romance book coming out from a local author. It's called Girls with Bad Reputations. Just the title right there.
Yes, I'm intrigued.
Tell me about that.
This one is actually, it's by Zio Axelrod, who's the local author. And her first book, this is a second book, but it's a standalone. It's a rock star romance. The rock star is a female drummer in an up-and-coming band. And it follows Kayla, who is the drummer, and she's kept her personal life and her band life very separate because her parents are not down with the whole I am a rock star. And she hooks up with a guy who's been falsely accused of plagiarism with sexual assault. It's derailed his academic career, and now he is the tour driver for this band on their first ever tour. And the look on your face.
Yeah, whoa. So much has already happened. We haven't even really gotten to the plot yet. Okay.
The plot is they bond,
yeah,
but they have so many secrets from yes. themselves, from each other, from the world. And of course, this band is becoming huge and the public eye is on them. And what do they do when all these things might start to come out?
Ooh.
Can they be there for each other or is everything going to crumble? And it is a romance, so it is not a spoiler to say it works out okay.
Ooh, I like girls it. With bad reputations, but apparently good endings, mm-hmm, by Zio Axelrod, that is a Philly writer.
Philly yeah, writer. Yeah. She lives down in South Philly. It comes out February 6th.
Fantastic.
Yep.
All right, I want to go out of Philly now.
Okay.
For this is the one on your list that probably most intrigued me initially.
Okay.
It's called Rental Person Who Does Nothing, and it's by an author by Shoji Morimoto. It's a memoir.
Yep.
Rental Person Who Does Nothing is kind of like a description of what Shoji Morimoto has done.
That's what he does.
That's what he does.
He became famous online about 2 years ago. He literally rents himself out to people and does nothing. Do you need someone to sit next to you while you're having coffee? He'll do it. Do you need someone to wave you off at a train station? He'll do it. Don't expect conversation. Don't expect him to do your chores for you, but if you need someone next to you for something, he will do it.
His service is his presence.
Yes, it's called the Do Nothing Rental Agency.
How did I not think of this?
This is a real thing. And so he wrote this book. Well, he's very clear that he didn't write this book. There were other people who wrote it because that would be doing something. And
right,
he did nothing. And I picked it up because I thought this was going to be like weird, but it's kind of a fun premise. But it's actually got these really great in-depth musings on the nature of meaningful connection and people's purposes in life and Japanese society. This all takes place in Japan, human psychology, but also the things that people feel they need to have someone else with them for. A lady hired him to just walk with her to drop off her divorce papers, things like that. And just having someone there, a complete stranger, allows them to actually do what they want to do with comfort.
That's
it's
so
such a good book. It is such a good book.
And it just shows you we're such social creatures, you know, and that there's some things you don't want to do alone.
Yeah. He actually started doing this because at his former job, his boss kept saying, you're so bad at this, you do nothing, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I wonder if I can actually make a living doing nothing. And that's how it all started.
That's a great hustle.
Yeah,
that is a great hustle. And of course, that book is coming out.
That actually is out. That came out January 9th. So if you're interested, you can read it now.
And we only have nothing.
Yeah, and we only have a couple more minutes. So I got to ask you to zoom out a bit.
Okay.
I'm not a big fiction person. I like the twists and turns, and it seems like you already, you know, you're into that as well. So your list is much broader, not just what's coming out now, but your list is very long. You've been doing this for a while. In your mind, what makes a really good piece of fiction?
I think for me, I am in some ways a little shallow. I need banter. I need, if you're going to interact with each other, it needs to be entertaining.
Okay.
But I think it needs to, you don't have to like the character, but you have to connect in some way to the character, whether you hate them, whether you love them. It's the ones that are like, why would I hang out with that person? That's where I have some trouble. But it needs
like
to
those anti-hero type of books? Or the people are too boring?
I think if a person's too boring, I'm like, why am I reading about you?
Yeah.
But yeah, you need to have, there needs to be something that hooks you into the character. There needs to be something about the plot that is like, oh, that's interesting. What happens next? Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, I've read books where nothing happens, but I've fallen in love with the people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you not real? Why can't you be my friend? Mm-hmm. What happens next? There's so many books where it ends, and it's not a series, but it ends. And I'm like, but I need to know more.
Are there any big trends in fiction right now? Because we just had a whole episode, like a segment on apocalypse and end of the world. What's the big thing in fiction
I would
now?
Not survive an apocalypse. No.
I'm with you.
You know, what I see at the library a lot now is so many people coming in looking for horror. Like horror was never huge, and now it's exploded. And I'm not sure. Usually you'll see that when things get really, really tense and horrible in the world, people start veering towards lighter stuff in their books. The other big one that we've really noticed is dark romance or dark fantasy. Dark romance, fantasy, if you put them all
together. What exactly is that?
That's when you get characters who are morally gray or not even gray, just morally black. But so usually with the dark ones, it's people who you would not want to meet in a dark alley, but they are a romance interest.
Interesting.
And the stories go pretty
dark.
I
can tell.
All right, all right.
You know how to pick them.
I just want to shout out real quickly.
Yes.
You also mentioned to us The Tainted Cup by Robert Jackson Bennett, mm-hmm. What Feast at Night by T. Kingfisher, and Women of Good Fortune by Sophie Wan. Thank you for all those suggestions. Mm-hmm. Dina Halick, Department Head, Philbrick Hall, the Fiction and DVD Department at the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
It was so nice being here. Thank you.
Well, that's it for our show today.
That's our week.
Yeah, for the week. You can follow WHYY on all social platforms and download us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, Andreas Copes, Al Banks engineered today's program. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Happy reading, everybody.
Yay.
And thank you for joining us.